Maybe I will use the step stool here. All right, there we go. Yeah. All right, good morning, everybody. I'm Misha, and I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Misha. We love you, Misha. Lots and lots and lots.
How much? So I have a quick caveat here. So for those of you who've been to lots of AA conferences, the Sunday morning speaker is often somebody with this really deep, powerful spiritual message. And often that person will like end the conference by singing Amazing Grace. That ain't happening. Sorry, you tried to warn the committee, but I will do what I can.
So, that's
the plan. Somebody could come up and do a little dance or something. All right, so before we get started, though, I want to invite you guys to all stand for a second, if you can. And if you're not comfortable standing, sit in a comfortable position. And what we're going to do is first I want everybody to just stretch a little, get a little air in. All right, now see if you can stand where you are with your feet about shoulder width apart and feel your feet kind of planted in the ground. All right, now I'd like everyone to put your left hand right where maybe your pinky finger is right on top of your belly button. And your right hand up here, like on top of your chest. All right. And I want everybody to close their eyes for a second and just feel yourself breathe. And if you can, breathe so that you only feel your left hand moving. So you're breathing from the diaphragm slowly, gently. And as you breathe in light and love and all of the wonderful energy of this conference. And breathe out your tiredness and any resentments or frustration you have. Just feel yourself breathe in and out. One. Two, breathe in. All right, after you take one last good breath, you can open your eyes. All right, thanks everybody. All right. So pretty much that's the sum of my spiritual practice. So we're done. No. I suppose I should tell you a little bit about how I got here, what happened, all that good stuff. But first, before I do that, I want to thank Connor and Tamara. Unfortunately, I couldn't be here Friday night, so I couldn't hear Tamara speak, but I did get to hear Connor, and you did a terrific job, and I heard great things about Tamara. And so thank you for doing such a great job and for carrying the message. And then I also want to thank all the people who were on the panels, because I heard some really amazing things yesterday, things I really needed to hear. And I thought all the panelists did a great job. And I also want to thank all the host committee members. So I wrote their names down because I wanted to catch them. All right, so Faraji, Kayla, Ann, Mike, Dylan, Sarah, wherever you are, Jeff, Alyssa, Candace, she's not here, Carolyn, Dan, Eric, Jesse, Margaret, Esme, Scott, Stephanie, James, Justice. Did I miss anybody? All right, thank you guys. James, I said James. I could say James again. All right, thank you guys all for doing such great work. you know, some of us have gotten to like just hear and see little bits and pieces of all the hard work you've done this year and all the meetings and all the planning, and we really appreciate it. I think it's done great things for our AA community here in Iowa City, and for those of us who've been involved in putting on conferences, we know this is hard. There's a lot of personalities. There's days that you're tired or crabby or you have a resentment. And, you know, you guys just kept showing up. And that's amazing. And so you've been a great example for how this program works. So thank you. Okay. All right. All right, so how about me? So back to me. So I don't know, I mean, I don't know when I became an alcoholic, but I do know that when I was a little kid, I always felt less than. And I remember being like, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years old, and I had a cousin who was a year older than I am, and it was Christmas, and we were going downstairs to play or something, and my mom said to my aunt, "Isn't that cute? Michelle is following Kristen around." And I was outraged. I don't follow anyone around. And I thought that like that meant that like I was not, you know, not enough, not good enough, that I would have to follow other people around. I mean, and I really, throughout my childhood, always felt like there was something not, I just was awkward, and I didn't make friends easily. I had a hard time talking to people, and I wasn't athletic. The only thing I did was like I sat in my room and read books. You know, I that was like my first drug, was just to like hide out and read books. And then when I was 9, it was New Year's Eve, and my best friend, Kathy Brown, and I decided that this was going to be our big New Year's. And so we stole a bottle of gin from my parents, and we didn't really know very much about mixing drinks, so we also got orange juice, and we mixed them about 50-50, if you can imagine. So we went out and we like found a spot like outside, like away from the families and all that stuff going on, I remember picking this drink of gin and orange juice. It was like in a soda bottle and like chugging it, and then almost immediately, projectile vomiting. And the reason that I like to remember this moment is that my next thought was not like, "Wah, run home to mom." It was like, "I gotta drink some more," right? So that night was actually my first blackout, because I did manage to drink some more and get some in that stayed down. And but what I really remember is like once I had enough in my system, I remember like looking up at the stars. And they were so twinkly. And I just felt like everything was all right, right? Like I was okay, I was funny, I was pretty, I was like kind of like people would talk to me. Like that was how I wanted to feel. And I basically chased that feeling for the next 20 years, 19 years. So when you're 9 and in, you know, the 4th or 5th grade, it's really hard to get served. So for me, like through like grade school and junior high, the best way to drink would be to like steal beers from my family, because you know, there'd be like a couple cases of beer, and so we'd, you know, my friend and I would like steal some beer, wrap it up in our towel, be like, "We're going to the beach," or like, "We're gonna go for a swim," and then we'd go out and drink, and then we'd, you know, throw the cans in the lake. You know, I didn't have a lot of consequences. I never got caught. I never had, you know, I didn't have, at that age, I didn't have any real terrible things happen to me. But when I look back, I can start to see that what I started to associate was that, for me, feeling okay, I equated with drinking. right? Like, that was how I, that was the only way I could really, like, socialize or feel good. And we moved around a bunch, and so eventually it sort of became my thing where I could get alcohol. And that was like my sort of claim to fame, right? That's how I made friends, and so if I probably owe lots of amends to people, like I started people on their journey that landed them here. Right? But by the time I was about 14, I was able to get served in liquor stores, which sounds scary to me. I like meet people who are 14 years old, and I'm like, wow, that's a child. Right? But like for some reason, like in some places, men are willing to serve young girls. And, you know, if you're bold enough to like walk in and like fill up a shopping cart full of liquor, then they'll, and you've got money, they'll take it. So I would do the, I would have these things where I would like have to have an older friend who's allowed to drive, who could drive to the liquor store and like park around the corner. And then I'd go in, I'd have everybody's money, and then I'd like go in, I'd fill up the cart, and the guy was always like, can I help you out to your car, miss? No, I've got it. I'd be like going around the corner, like worrying that they're gonna find me and see that I've got a car full of junior high school kids. You know, even back then, I didn't have a lot of consequences, except that when I look back, I start to see that the more I drank, the more I kind of checked out from my family, right? So when today, like when I have family events or things, and my brother and sister are like talking about what life was like back then, it's like we grew up in completely different households. Like, they have memories of things that I was not even present for. And, I mean, I think probably it was because I was drunk or drinking or trying to figure out how to get drunk, but I don't even remember what they were. Like, I was just checked out. And it wasn't until, you know, I had a couple years of sobriety and I was making amends that I realized that, like, I was a crappy sister. I really was. I didn't kill anybody in sobriety, you know. Like when it came time to like making amends, a lot of my amends were these like more like subtle things. Like I was a terrible sister, and like maybe my sister or my brother needed someone to talk to, and it never occurred to me to be present for them. Never. So I drank my way through high school, started smoking pot. The summer before the ninth grade, started getting into, you know, all kinds of trouble. Mostly, like, I didn't really get caught a lot, but I would get into these situations that just felt really dangerous because I had no ability to say no. Like, we were living in New Jersey at the time, and so if you're a kid and you could just go into New York City and, like, drink and go to clubs and go dancing and go score drugs, and you know, when I look back, I think it's terrifying to think of, like, you know, if you had a 16-year-old sister or brother and they were, like, going into New York City on their own to go score drugs, you would be like, no. But for me, I never thought, like, this is dangerous. You know, I thought, oh, I wouldn't want to get arrested. That seemed like that would be bad. But it never occurred to me that, like, I was really putting myself in harm's way. And I had friends who would say, like, oh, I heard about this great place where we could, like, go dancing and we'd end up, like, in some horrible neighborhood where there's, like, a great place to dance. But then, you know, when you're 15 or 16, you have hardly any money, so you can't, like, just take a cab whenever you want to get out of a dangerous situation. I mean, it was crazy. I was kind of pedal to the metal. Like, I just didn't have any breaks at all. And that ended up impacting my family life. It impacted my schooling. I managed to graduate from high school, but I had to go to summer school to do it. So I didn't walk on graduation. I didn't go to prom or any of those things. My picture isn't even in the high school yearbook because I was like, I don't want to be associated with those people. So I was a young person who really drank to fit in. And I think, like, when I look around, I think, wow, I qualified to be here really young. I just never knew that this was a possibility, right? I do remember once, like, we had changed schools and I was at a new school. I was 15 and there was a ski trip. And I really wanted to make friends. I mean, I really was struggling. And so there's this ski trip, and I convinced my parents that I wanted to go on this ski trip, and then I saved money and babysat and whatever. And so I went on this ski trip, but I didn't know anybody. So I brought a bottle of Jack Daniels with me. And I thought, well, I'm going to share this Jack Daniels with these other kids, and then I'll have some friends. But I was so awkward that I remember sitting in this hotel room, and, you know, they have those little glasses in the bathroom, the little water glasses, and I poured some Jack Daniels in the glass, and I was sitting in the room having a drink by myself, and I thought to myself, oh, my God, this is what alcoholics do. And I was 15. And, that thought didn't, you know, it's funny when I look back, I think that thought was not followed by, hey, you should get some help. It was more like, oh, shit. And then, like, you have to hide this. And, you know, the funny part is that I have parents who love me. I had other adults in my life who loved me. And I think if I had gone to them and said, hey, I'm in trouble, I think that they would have been so happy to help. But I had no language for that. And I think that except for that one moment, I never associated the crappiness of my life with the drinking and the drugs. And I would tell you that all the way up until the moment when I actually surrendered, I would have said, if you had asked me to get really honest and tell you what my problem was, the only thing I could have told you is that I'm a failure. Deep down, I'm bad at everything. I can't make friends, I can't show up, I'm bad with money, I'm irresponsible, I'm a terrible person. Basically, I'm just a failure, and I'm working really hard to fake it so that to try and get you to like me. And I had no idea that what my real problem was alcoholism. I had no idea. So I just was, you know, trying to hide this fact that deep down I was a failure. And I don't know where that idea comes from. It seems like, looking back, it seems really sad, you know? And I know that I'm not the only one who felt like that. And I feel like, for a lot of us alcoholics, we're really sensitive. Like, we might look like jerks on the outside, right? We might be like, you know, pissing in somebody's car or like stealing their money or, you know, doing terrible things. But like deep down, we have these like big tender hearts. And it's really hard to be in the world and not be medicated. So we medicate ourselves, right? So we medicate ourselves, and you know, Connor talked last night about like that God-sized hole, right? You know, we have that, and we're really sensitive. And I also have noticed that, you know, when you meet lots of alcoholics, like so many of us have tried to like find spiritual solutions while we're still drinking. Right? We change religions, we are born again, we go on retreats, we become Buddhists, we do meditation, we like start yoga, we try these things and we're hoping for something because we have a sense, I think, that like that there's something we want to connect to. And it's just that alcohol is like blocking us. Right? That drugs, the fear, the resentments, all that stuff blocks us from what, you know, folks in AA call the sunlight of the spirit. But we're trying, you know, and we have these big tender hearts. And we just get hurt, and so then we drink more and act like jerks, right? So fast forward, I drank a lot, I did a lot of drugs, blah, 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 right? So So my pattern, my basic pattern is this. I work in a bar. I date somebody from that bar. I try to go to school. I generally will flunk out of school, the relationship goes to hell, or I quit the job, and then I move. Right, so if you look at my track record, I lived in New York and Boston, Seattle, and I would just bounce around. I was just trying to find my place, but it was, the answer was always just leave, right? Something's blowing up, so I gotta go. And so eventually I end up in Seattle, and I will tell you that here's an indication, I'm about to get sober, so here's an indication of how sick I am, right? So my parents, over time they got more and more worried about me, and I got more and more checked out, and they were living in New Jersey and I was in Seattle, and eventually they called and they said, "We know something's wrong with you. We want to help." And I did not want to give up drugs and drinking, right? So I said, "Well, Mom and Dad, it's because I'm gay. I think I'm depressed. If you send me some money, I can go to therapy." I'm a terrible human being. I had no bad feelings about being gay. I was very happy to be out in the bars and dating women and whatever. I just thought, if I can deflect attention from my drinking and get some money from it, it seems like a win-win. Terrible. I'm still making amends. So while I'm living out in Seattle, I start doing crystal meth, and then that takes my drinking to boom, right? I think I probably could have drank for another 10 years. But once you add crystal meth in, everything gets faster, including your bottom. So I end up homeless. I have this really crazy girlfriend who's always trying to kill herself. I am doing drugs every day. I can't hold down a job. And I think I'm doing okay, right? And my parents are and by this time I don't have a phone, I don't have an address, I don't have anything. So my parents call one of my friends, and they tell her, "We don't know where Misha is, and we're really worried." So my friend goes around and leaves messages for me. And so this is the way it works. I walk into a bar, and the bartender says, "Hey, Misha, call your mother." What? And then I leave there, whatever. And then I go to a different bar, and the bartender's like, "Hey, Misha, I got a message for you. Call your mother." The end all was when I got to my drug dealer's house. Seriously. He's like, "Honey, I've got a little something for you set up in the bathroom. The phone is in there. You take care of business and then call your mother." So, when they talk about low companions, I have to say, first of all, that I was a low companion, but second of all, that the people in my life who were drug dealers and bartenders, they saved my life. Right? Yes. And so I'm eternally grateful, and I'm always on the lookout to see if I see them in a meeting. I hope I do. Or I hope that they're happy wherever they are. But the other thing that happened, I go in the bathroom, I call my mother, she says, "We want you to come home." I said, "I'm a little short right now. I could come in a couple months." And she's like, "No, we're buying a plane ticket. If you can just get to the airport." And I was like, I'm thinking, I don't know if I even have money to get to the airport. And my drug dealer took me to the airport. So I get home, my family does an intervention, and I'm thinking, you don't understand.
My problem isn't that drugs and alcohol. My problem is that deep down I'm a failure, right? There's something fundamentally deeply wrong with me that, like, treatment isn't going to fix. However, I'm homeless. So, like, you know, three hots and a cot sounds not too bad, right? It's starting to get cold out. And I thought to myself, wow, you know, if I go to treatment, they'll probably give me some money, like, afterwards, like, to get set up, like, to get an apartment or something. And so, like, I could just get back on my feet again, right? I had no interest in getting sober because I didn't think that was my problem. And then the other thing was that I had had this drug dealer who was in prison, and he used to call collect all the time. And because when you're in prison, you got nothing to do and you got no money. So he would call me collect. And one time when we were having this conversation, he said, you know, Misha, if you ever get a chance to go to treatment, you should go. Because people in treatment are really nice. And I was like, okay. So all this, it's a way of saying that I did agree to go to treatment. And while I was there, I started to hear the message. They would have AA meetings, speakers would come in, and I started to get this little inkling that maybe my problem was alcoholism and drugs. I had no idea. And the first time I sat in a meeting and I said, my name is Misha and I'm an alcoholic, like, I just burst into tears. Because I knew it was true, and I also knew that it meant that my life was over. It was the end of the fucking world. Sorry, I shouldn't swear on the tape, sorry. So I really knew it was the end of the world, and I didn't know what to do about it, right? So I kind of thought, well, maybe I'll go back to the drugging and drinking, because that's all I know. Or maybe I'll try and stay sober, I don't know. And then a girl that I was in treatment with left early to go be with her boyfriend, and then they found her dead. And I was like, oh, right, that could happen. Like, that hadn't really occurred to me. Although I had a lot of friends who had died, it hadn't occurred to me that that could be me. And then there were some women who came into the treatment center who were, like, old and getting sober. And I was like, oh, and that could be me. So I had this thought, like, oh, man, I should probably give this thing a try. So at first I was not, like, I thought, I'll just stay sober. But I didn't know that, like, all the things that you were talking about, like getting honest, having a spiritual experience, being willing, I didn't know you actually meant it. I just thought they were, like, slogans, right? So I was in this halfway house, and one of my friends, it was her birthday, and she said, let's go out tonight. And I was like, okay, you know, I'm up for anything. And so there's one lesbian bar in St. Paul, Minnesota, and she's like, we're going there. And I was like, okay, it sounds good to me. And I had, like, hardly any money, so I said, I don't know, we'll just go and dance and whatever. And we get there, and she said, it's my birthday, I'm gonna drink. And I was like, no, you shouldn't. We're going to get kicked out of the halfway house. Meanwhile, because I haven't worked any steps. I have no principles. I'm not doing anything to stay sober. But I have this idea that I can just stay sober on willpower. So she says, no. It's my birthday. I'm just going to have one. Okay. And she said, just walk. Come up to the bar with me. So I walk up to the bar with her. It's hazy after, like, halfway across the dance floor. And then the next thing I know, I'm ordering my second drink. Honest to God, like, hand on a Bible, I do not remember ordering that first drink. I don't remember it. It's like something took over. And, you know, later, you know, what my sponsor explained to me is I'm powerless over alcohol. And without a spiritual experience, without spiritual help, I can't help it. So if you put some drugs in front of me or you put a drink in front of me, I'm just going to do it, right? That's who I am. I am bottomless. I have no breaks. I have no ability to say no. I have no ability to make good choices. So I got drunk that night with her, and so we agreed, this goes to the grave with us. Never tell anyone. So we get back to the halfway house, and the next morning, like, I get called into the office, and the counselor says, we knew you were drinking last night. I was like, no, it wasn't me. So they call in some more counselors, and they sit us down. There's like four of us in this little tiny office, and they're like, Nisha, we know you were drinking. And I was like, you do not. You weren't there. I wasn't drinking. And because I thought, I'm just going to go to the grave with this. It went back and forth and back and forth. And then I realized, wow. Like, one of the counselors kind of looked at his watch, and I realized, he's like, it's like the end of his shift. He's like, got to go home and make dinner or something. And then it occurred to me, for him, this was just a job. For me, this sobriety is my life. If I want this, if I want to have a life, I have to be willing to be honest and to really show up for it. It doesn't matter if I lie to that guy. If I'm lying to myself, if I'm not willing to accept the consequences and do what it takes to stay sober, I'm not gonna. And it was like, right? And at that moment, I just surrendered, right? Okay, higher power, whatever it takes. Now, I have to tell you that night that I drank, it was 15 below. This is in Minnesota. I'd never lived in Minnesota, so I didn't know anyone except the other people in the treatment center. I had about $5 in my pocket, and I knew that if I drank, I would get kicked out of the halfway house. So I drank anyway, because I can't think of consequences, right? And so I knew that by telling them, by admitting that I had been drinking, that I was going to get kicked out, that probably meant I was going to be homeless on a night when it was 15 below, and I knew no one and had no money. And, you know, by the grace of my higher power, they decided, well, we're going to let you stay if you make a commitment to your sobriety and to working the first step and to really being here. And I was like, wow, I cannot believe that they're letting me stay here. And I stayed, and I just got serious. And, you know, the other people in the halfway house were pissed at me. And it was like all of a sudden I had no friends, no one to talk to. And I just walked around, and I had to come to this realization that my sobriety was between me and my higher power. Because all these people who I thought were my friends, fun, laugh, blah, 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 they weren't going to be able to help me stay sober, right? Fellowship helps. But ultimately, that sobriety is between me and my higher power. And I had to really know that, and know that even if no one was talking to me, that I could still stay sober. I got a sponsor, started going to meetings, started following my sponsor around like a puppy dog, right? And at first it was really hard. I realized I said this to somebody yesterday. When I got sober, there was this like gang of like young women that I thought they were like really cool and really fun, and I wanted to be friends with them, but they were really mean. They were not nice people. And then my sponsor had like these sponsees, and they seemed kind of like boring and old. But you know what? They're old like 35, right? But you know, they were work in programs, and they were the kind of people who would show up for you, and the kind of people who would take the time to listen and go to a meeting with you and go out for coffee afterwards. You know, they were people who were really actually friends. And so I had to like shift my idea of like, what was important here? Is it important to like look good and like be with the right crowd, or is it important to be with the people who are really going to support your sobriety. And my sponsor is a person who does like a ton of service. So I got involved in service right away. And I did 90 meetings in 90 days. And by the time I got done with those 90 meetings in 90 days, I felt like I was really like invested in Alcoholics Anonymous. I cared about you guys. I cared about your stories. I wanted to know what would happen. Like when it was time to like, you know, like pare back my meetings, like I could go to like 5 a week or something, I was like, wow, I don't want to give up any of these meetings because like I really like seeing all the people at all the different meetings. So I kept going to a lot of meetings. And, you know, eventually I started sponsoring women. And that to me was like really the place where the joy happened, right? Where I got to see like other people change. And it like, oh my God, like to see somebody come in and like be broken and sad and like just have nothing. And then to see the kind of like blossoming that like so many of you guys are doing is just an amazing gift. It's so amazing to just get to stand there and watch and see how that happens. And I got involved in like organizing conferences like this. And I have to tell you, so one of the conferences that I got really involved in is the International AA Women's Conference. So if any of you women are interested, this coming year, it's gonna be in LA. And then I think it's gonna be in Phoenix, but it's gonna be really fun. But so I got involved in the AA Women's Conference, and the hilarious thing about that is, you know, at about 10 years sober, I was working on the bid committee to bring the conference to Minneapolis, and these like women were kind of like, keep coming back, dear. Like they were like, they were people with like a million years of sobriety. And I was like 10 years sober. I thought like, oh, I got some sobriety. But these women like 40 years, 50 years of sobriety. And so even now, right now I have 21 years of sobriety. And even today when I go to this conference, some of them like sort of like pat me and tell me to keep coming back. Which I love. I love it. I love that they like, you know, they saw me when I was a brand newcomer and they've watched me for 20 years and they're still watching out for me, right? And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous is that you can stick with people and over a lifetime, you can see people grow and have kids and have their lives change and be transformed. And it's pretty amazing. This is an amazing life we get to live. I mean, the things that have happened to me in sobriety, not just like sponsoring women and getting involved in service. I went back and finished college. Woo, totally amazing. I had dropped out of about 10 colleges. I have a hilarious transcript. Because it's like A's and F's. Because basically I would start off and I'd be really raring to go. And I could make it like maybe one semester. And then like by the second semester, everything goes to hell. Right? Then by the second semester, I'm thinking I should study in the bar. Right? So AF, 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 all the way across. And then eventually in sobriety, my sponsor, I was talking to my sponsor about how it made me really anxious and fearful that I didn't have a degree. And I thought, how am I going to like have a career? And she said, well, why don't you go back to school? And I was so afraid of it because I was afraid of this past that followed me around. And she said, what's going to hurt to just like apply? Oh, I don't know, right? And so I went back to school, I finished my undergraduate degree, and a couple years later, I was like, wow, that school thing wasn't too bad. And my job is kind of like, I don't know, I was like possibly getting laid off, so I thought, maybe I'll apply to grad school. So I did, I applied to grad school, and I ended up going here to the University of Iowa and getting a PhD. And, you know, I will tell you that the spiritual part of that for me is that I was really terrified that I had done serious damage to my brain cells. Anyone, I'm sure a few of you might relate, right? Like, a lot of acid, a lot of crystal meth. I was like, I actually don't want to know, right? Like, I feel like I did bad things, and I kind of am just going to try and avoid this. And but when I went and I took the GRE, and it's like an exam to get into grad school, I thought, I think I did okay. Like, I'm sure I probably would have more brain cells if I hadn't done what I'd done, right? But I have enough to get by. And that to me felt like this amazing, like just this gift, right? That we can be healed and transformed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I traveled abroad for I did research in other countries for my dissertation. I lived in Bangladesh for about a year and a half. And that was amazing. There aren't meetings in Bangladesh. So I'll tell you this one story really quickly. So there weren't any meetings in Bangladesh, but I did find by like networking with lots of people that there's one woman who is in AA. So when I got there, I called her up, and so we started meeting, and then she had a job transfer. And so then I was back to being by myself. And so I was doing some online meetings, and that was great, and I was emailing my sponsor a lot. But I thought, I need to do something to, like, be of service. So I had heard about this this Catholic brother from Iowa who had been living in Bangladesh for 40 years, and he was running this orphanage. So I thought, I could go be of service there. So I call him up, and he's like, whoa, that's weird, Iowa. So he's like, meet me at this place, and I'll take you out there. And I don't know what you can do, but like, you could just come and see the place. Okay, so I went out there, and as we're talking, he starts to explain to me that that most of the kids that they had brought into this orphanage had been living in this train station and had become addicted to drugs. Mostly. They were sniffing glue and doing heroin, and then there's this form of crystal meth there that they call yaba, and so all these kids were doing a lot of drugs. And so he said, when we started this orphanage, you know, we just thought we could teach them and give them a safe place to live, but then we realized that we had to have like kind of a treatment center. And so they had been doing this for about 20 years, and so there were a couple guys who had been sober now for about 10 years, and they had come back there to work with the younger kids. And they had just started having women come there. Now, in Bangladesh, it's a Muslim country, and it's a very serious sin to drink alcohol. And so people really don't like to admit that they've drank alcohol. And women especially is really frowned upon. So here were these women, young women, who were in this treatment center slash orphanage. A lot of them were like teenagers. And they didn't have anyone. So the little boys had a couple guys who had been sober, who were trying to carry the message to them. And they didn't have AA material, but they had a kind of 12-step model that they had learned from some treatment centers in India. But the women didn't have anything. They had these social workers who were like super disapproving, right? Like these social workers who were like, you know, you shouldn't be promiscuous, you shouldn't drink, you shouldn't do drugs, you should take care of your children, you know, that sort of like that. So I said, well, can I just sit down with these women and talk to them? And at the time, I didn't speak the local language very well. And none of them spoke English, but I said, I just want to try this. So I sat down with these women and I told them my story as best I could with my kind of fragmented language. And by the time we got done, and I talked very explicitly about like being promiscuous, being an asshole, like being like untrustworthy, like, because I wanted them to know that like it was okay, that like you could have lived like that and then you could change. And by the time I got done, like, these women, I felt like I had really connected with them. And I had no idea how. I felt like I had suddenly, like, learned the language, learned, like, some language skills that I didn't know I even had. But I connected with them, so I started going back and as often as I could to go there and, like, have meetings with them. And, you know, some of them, there was an AA meeting that was started. It was more like a treatment meeting. But after that, they started allowing the women to go to the meeting. And, you know, I don't know that I made a difference in any of their lives long term, but I know that it kept me sober, right? So the message for me was that even when I don't think that I can carry the message or be of service in the way that we're taught to be of service here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I can be of service in other ways, and it can also, like, save my butt, right? If I'm not thinking, I'm a terrible multitasker, so I can't think about you and think about me at the same time. So I'm thinking about you, I can't think about me, right? And if I'm thinking about me, I can't think about you. So when I'm being of service and thinking about you, just for a minute, I get some relief from my self-centeredness, right? So I'm almost done here. And I want to say that I'm really grateful for all of the gifts that Alcoholics Anonymous has brought to my life. And most especially, my sponsor says that, she says, you know, you don't have to have lots of friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it makes it a lot more fun. Right? And what I've seen here this weekend has been like this amazing example of joy and fellowship and people carrying the message. And I want to say thank you for all of that. So. Thank you.